Hello, I'm Jackie Leonard from the Global News Podcast. Every day we bring you the very best of our BBC World Service news coverage from our correspondents across the world. The biggest news stories and detailed analysis, including from our World Update programme. I hope you like our podcast. If you do, search for Global News wherever you find your podcasts. If you subscribe, you'll get every edition automatically.
This is the BBC. For details of our complete range of programmes, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Welcome to the latest global news, compiled in the early hours of the morning on Tuesday the 28th of November. I'm Nick Miles with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up, how a royal engagement was sealed.
He got on one knee.
Of course. Was it an instant yes from you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I could barely let you finish proposing. I said, can I say yes now?
She didn't even let me finish. She said, can I say yes? Can I say yes now? And then there was hugs and I had the ring in my finger. And I was like, can I give you the ring? And she goes, oh, yes, the ring.
We get reaction to Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's news and ask how it's likely to affect attitudes to the British royal family. Also in the podcast, the Indonesian authorities have urged more than 100,000 people living near a volcano on the island of Bali to move to safety due to fears that an explosive eruption could be imminent. The European Union has decided to renew the licence for the weed killer glyphosate for 5 years, despite concerns that it could be carcinogenic. And later, the value of the virtual currency Bitcoin has jumped to a new record, raising concern among international regulators.
People have been comparing it to the tulip craze in Holland in the 17th century. People are basically buying it because they think it'll be worth more tomorrow.
But first, Britain's Prince Harry and his American fiancée, Meghan Markle, have spoken to the BBC about their excitement at their engagement, which they announced on Monday. Queen Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh said they were delighted by the news. But before listening to the interview, let's get a sense of the reaction here in London.
That's wonderful.
It's fantastic.
I'm thrilled for them.
Fantastic. Come down, especially to see the announcement. I think they're going to make a great team.
Did he get engaged? To Meghan? Really? Oh my God, congratulations to them.
My mom just texted me about it, so we like wanted to come and see. It's really cool. Yeah, it's so exciting. Yeah, we're on a holiday and we're here, and so it was exciting that it happened this weekend.
I think she's a cracking girl, very good actress.
I think it's delightful. I mean, the public probably won't ever be able to get enough royal weddings. I grew up in the United States, but I've been living in New Zealand for 45 years, so I'm sure the world will be excited.
The BBC's Michelle Hussein met the happy couple at Kensington Palace. First, she asked them how they became engaged.
It happened a few weeks ago, earlier this month, here at our cottage. It's a standard, typical night for us.
It's a cosy night. What were we doing? Just roasting chicken
roasting
and having...
Trying to roast a chicken.
Trying to roast a chicken. And it was just an amazing surprise. It was so sweet and natural and very romantic. He got on one knee.
Of course. Was it an instant yes from you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I could barely let you finish proposing. I said, can I say yes now?
She didn't even let me finish. She said, can I say yes? Can I say yes now? And then there was hugs and I had the ring in my finger. And I was like, can I give you the ring? And she goes, oh, yes, the ring. So, no, it was a really nice moment. It was just the two of us. And I think I managed to catch her by surprise as well. So.
Yeah. And this is how long after you first met?
Oh, it would be a year and a half, a little bit more than that?
No, just about a year and a half, yeah.
Which for most people would be quite a whirlwind. Is that how it's felt to you?
I don't think that I would call it a whirlwind in terms of our relationship. Obviously, there have been layers attached to how public it has become. After we had a good 5-6 months almost with just privacy, which was amazing. But no, I think we were able to really have so much time just to connect, and we never went longer than 2 weeks without seeing each other, even though we were obviously doing a long distance relationship. So we made it work.
How did you first meet?
Yes, we first met. We were introduced actually by a mutual friend who
we should protect her privacy
and not reveal
too much of that.
And but it was through her, and then we met once and then twice, back-to-back, two dates in London last July.
Yes.
Beginning of July. And then it was, I think, about 3, maybe 4 weeks later that I managed to persuade her to come and join me in Botswana, and we camped out with each other under the stars. We spent, she came and joined me for 5 days out there, which was absolutely fantastic. So then we were really by ourselves, which was crucial to me to make sure that we had a chance to get to know each other.
Have you met the Queen?
I have, yes.
A couple of times.
Yes, what was that like? A couple of times. It's incredible. I think, you know, to be able to meet her through his lens, not just with his honor and respect for her as the monarch, but the love that he has for her as his grandmother.
Your ring.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about your ring.
The ring is obviously yellow gold, because that's her favorite. And the main stone itself, a source from Botswana. And the little diamonds either side are from my mother's jewelry collection to make sure that she's with us on this crazy journey together. Mm. And
it's beautiful. And he designed it. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think your mother would have thought of Meghan or said about Meghan?
Oh, they'd be thick as thieves. Without question. I think she would be over the moon, jumping up and down, you know, so excited for me. But then, as I said, we'd have probably been best friends with Meghan. So no, it is days like today when I really miss having her around and miss being able to share the happy news. But, you know, with the ring and with everything else that's going on, I'm sure she's with us, yeah. You know, jumping up and down somewhere else.
I spoke to our royal correspondent, Daniela Rolfe, and I asked her if Meghan Markle's arrival into the British royal family will bring any changes.
I think she will, just by virtue of being an American to start with. You know, she brings something very different to the party here. She is not a traditional royal bride. She's American, she's divorced, she's an actress. She's got this strong background in humanitarian work and campaigning. She's not a woman drawn from a grand British aristocratic family, which is what traditionally often royal brides have come from. So, you know, she is something very different. And I think she brings a sort of American sensibility to the royal family, a sense of optimism. You know, in that interview this afternoon, she was very articulate, at ease with herself in front of the cameras. And, you know, there was a constant reference to them as a team. And it gave you a very immediate sense that they clearly have this vision of how they can work together, how they can make change, and how they want to continue with these shared interests of this charity work and humanitarian work to really make change and make a difference.
Yeah, and the Queen and Prince Philip, they've stopped carrying out foreign trips. Prince Charles is almost 70. How busy a schedule can we expect Harry and Meghan to take on?
Yeah, a very busy schedule, I think. And actually, they touched on that themselves in a different part of the interview, where she talked about wanting to get to know the Commonwealth, was a phrase she used. So clearly, they have a sort of global vision in terms of the kind of work that they are going to do together. And as you said then, you know, there is a gap here, because the Queen is doing less international travel. There's a limit to how much Prince Charles can do. And so you have this sort of powerhouse in many ways of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and now Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, who between the four of them can take on an awful lot of work and become very much a sort of global public image of the British royal family.
That was our royal correspondent, Daniela Rolfe. A political row has broken out in Washington over who is to head a financial watchdog after President Trump disregarded the initial choice and appointed a Republican politician instead. A White House spokeswoman said Mick Mulvaney, who was chosen by Mr. Trump on Friday, had legal standing to take charge of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders, said Mick Mulvaney would transform the office.
We think that a lot of the past practices under the previous director and under the previous administration were used more to advance political ambitions and not about protecting American consumers, which is what that's supposed to be. And our goal is to make sure we get back to that.
The person who'd first been appointed head, Leandra English, is taking legal action to try to block the government's intervention. Massive columns of thick grey smoke are billowing from Mount Agung. The fear is that the volcano on the Indonesian island of Bali is about to erupt violently, and the authorities have urged more than 100,000 people living nearby to move to safety. That's at least 12 kilometres away from the volcano. So why is it so difficult to predict exactly what the volcano will do now? And how dangerous could a big eruption be to people's health? Tim Frank spoke to Claire Howell from Durham University. She's director of the International Volcanic Health Hazard Network. But first, David Pyle, a volcanologist and professor of earth sciences at Oxford University.
The challenge that volcanoes like Agung pose to us is that the last eruption was in the 1960s, before the modern era of volcano monitoring. The eruption before that was in the 1840s, long before there were detailed records of what actually happened. So we have a volcano which is presenting a serious amount of unrest that developed through September, and the scientists who are engaged in the monitoring of the volcano are having to learn what those particular signs are telling them, and that's what people are learning in real time right now.
And what are the signals they're looking at?
So initially, the first signs of unrest from the volcano were the earthquakes, and we can measure where those earthquakes are from the way that the sound has travelled through the volcano, and they're generally caused by the breaking of rock as the magma pushes its way to the surface. But unusually, in this case, there was a lot of earthquake activity through October, and then it died away, and now the eruption has started. Right now, they'll be using information from other ground-based instruments. So there are instruments measuring how the shape of the volcano is changing due to the changes in pressure inside the volcano. They'll have instruments where they're trying to measure the gas that's coming out of the volcano. Some of those might be on the ground, but we also have satellite instruments.
Claire, we're already seeing these, what to me, look like enormous clouds of ash spewing from the mouth of the volcano. How significant are they, and how potentially damaging are they?
At the moment, we would class this as a fairly small-scale eruption, although there has been quite a lot of ash coming out of the volcano in recent days. And the ash itself does not pose a great danger to the communities around them. It's a nuisance. If it's very heavy, then it can put buildings at danger of the roofs collapsing. But as it stands right now, for healthy people, it's more of a nuisance than anything else.
If the volcano were to erupt, I realise I may be asking you to measure a piece of string, but just how far might an ash cloud travel and what effect might it have?
Well, the volcano is currently erupting now. If it were to have a large explosion, the distance that the ash could travel depends very much on the size of that explosion and the direction of the wind. As I mentioned, for most healthy people, the ash is not going to pose a great risk to them. It may give them discomfort, they may cough a bit, they may get sore eyes. For people that have existing respiratory problems or perhaps cardiovascular problems, then it's very advisable that they try to reduce their exposure. And to be honest, most other people will want to reduce their exposure too, because living with ash is quite unpleasant. So the first form of protection is always to try and remove yourself from that exposure. So obviously it's very hard for people to move away, especially when you're living on an island and the airports are closed. But people should try to go indoors. And if it's not possible, then there are ways of trying to seal up your house.
David, in terms of the Global League of Volcanoes, Claire corrected me by saying this is already erupting. It's just that it hasn't fully exploded yet. Were it to unleash its full power, just how much damage could it wreak?
So I think the interesting thing about the Agung volcano is that the last eruption in 1963 was a very significant eruption globally, but actually the amount of ash and pumice that was thrown out during that eruption wasn't huge.
Can I just interrupt you? You say globally. What was the global effect?
So the global effect of the 1963 eruption was that when the volcano reached a climactic phase of eruption, which is after about a month of unrest, the ash cloud went up very high, 20 to 25 kilometres, and it released a considerable amount of sulfur dioxide. So in fact, it led to a global cooling which was detectable with instruments at that time.
Of what sort of order?
Probably about a half a degree of Celsius for a couple of years.
That's quite significant, isn't it?
So it was significant, and actually the Agung eruption was significant for science because it was pretty much the first eruption of the modern era where people were able to make measurements to confirm that this was one of the consequences of volcanic eruptions on the climate system.
That was David Pyle, a volcanologist at Oxford University, and before him, Claire Howell, Associate Professor at the Department of Earth Sciences at Durham University. The European Union has decided to renew the licence for the weed killer glyphosate for 5 years, despite concerns that it could be carcinogenic. It comes amid conflicting health advice about the chemical, the world's biggest selling weed killer. One World Health Organization study 2 years ago concluded it probably caused cancer, but the European Chemicals Agency says the available evidence does not warrant it being listed as a carcinogen. Protesters gathered before the vote outside the European Commission building in Brussels to voice their opposition. Luis Morago is a spokesperson for the Avaaz campaign group.
Overall, there is like a major scientific and medical issue is that not only there is like amazing evidence about the impact on the environment, but also we are growingly seeing like a huge body of evidence, independent evidence, linking glyphosate with cancer.
So why has the EU made this decision? Here's Gareth Barlow.
Well, it's agreed to another 5 years, but it's important to state that originally it was considering giving it another 10 years, but there's been an awful lot of pressure on the EU Commission to reduce that and not to give it any licence at all. But it's gone to 5 years, and many lobbyists don't want to see it in circulation, in use in agricultural production at all. They cite a 2015 study by the World Health Organization that said it was probably carcinogenic. But the EU agencies, some of them from within the EU and also the UN, have said that it's unlikely to cause cancer within humans. And so on that basis, the EU Commission looked at its member states and said, we want you to make the decision. We ended up with today's ruling, 18 in favour, 9 against, and that one abstention. And the farming communities, they are delighted. But of course, many environmental lobbyists are far from that.
Indeed. And also we're hearing the French government, they're reacting very strongly to this.
Yes, incredibly so. The French farming minister said they would change farming practices. The President Emmanuel Macron said that they wanted to end its use as soon as there's an alternative available, certainly within 3 years. But that brings us to the key point about that alternative. It is so good at doing what it does, of killing green plants, that over the last 40 or so years, there's not been a need for the industry to come up with many more alternatives. If you do want an alternative, what are you going to use?
You mentioned that there are very mixed reports. Some reports from the European Union say it's unlikely to cause cancer. Others from the UN say it's probably carcinogenic. So it's very confusing for the public, isn't it?
Hugely so. And then you've got this huge, very, very important farming community that at the end of the day puts food on our table saying this is vital. Without it, prices will go up. To make an individual decision, I think, is what it will come down to for many people. They will look and say, we're going to only now go and shop in an organic store, I'm going to buy organic products. And many other people will say, well, it's only one report. They said probably carcinogenic. I'm drinking wine, I'm eating bacon and sausages, and I'm doing a lot of other unhealthy things in my life. What does it matter?
Gareth Barlow. You're listening to Global News, the most important stories and the best interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend, you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week, and the programme is also available to download from our website, www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. Children born near the site of an oil spill are twice as likely to die in their first month, according to new research by scientists at the University of Gallen in Switzerland. They looked at the birth histories of thousands of mothers in Nigeria. The Niger Delta has experienced years of onshore oil spills as a result of negligence by oil companies, militant attacks and oil theft. From southern Nigeria, the BBC's Stephanie Hegarty sent this report.
When I had the baby, there was no problem. But then I was carrying him in my arms. He took 3 breaths and then he was gone.
Love Sunday lives in Kedere, a small town in the Niger Delta. She's in her early 30s, but even when she smiles shyly, her eyes are heavy and red with tears. She looks a little older. In October, she lost her son, 2 weeks after he was born.
I'm still mourning. I weep every day.
She doesn't know how her baby died because she didn't see a doctor. But Love is far from the only one in her village dealing with this kind of loss.
When I meet the doctor...
Patient Sunday and her husband, Batim, were also expecting their first child in October. Patients told me the doctor said not to use rainwater because the rain contains oil.
They were taking care of the baby.
A few hours after her baby was born, he collapsed, she said.
He said that he was so weak. That was the reason.
And in 2014, Barinada Saturday and her husband, Chief Bira Saturday, also lost their first and only child. All of these families live in Kedere, a town that has seen numerous spills, most recently in 2012 and 2014.
Our farming area is always damp with this oil. And as we are walking, you will be perceiving the odor.
The doctor said that it affects the baby in my womb.
I'm at a spill site, and it's only about 2 kilometres from the families that we just met. This would be a beautiful place, surrounded in tall bamboo trees, but it's black and caked with oil. There's pools of dark, sticky black liquid. There's oil everywhere. A new report by scientists at the University of Gallen in Switzerland says this oil could be the reason these babies are dying. The report compared data from 2 sources, a list of the date and location of oil spills, and records of the birth histories of thousands of Nigerian mothers. They looked at children who were conceived after a spill within 10 kilometres of it and compared their health outcomes with those of their siblings who were conceived before the spill. They found that babies conceived after an oil spill were twice as likely to die in their first month. There's little research on the effects of crude oil on human health. Almost none of it is in Nigeria. What little evidence there is paints a grim picture. Dr. Vincent Welly is an expert in air pollution at the University of Port Harcourt.
If during the formation of the pregnancy their mother was exposed to crude, it's capable of affecting brain formation, has the ability of affecting the formation of other organs of the body.
There have been hundreds of oil spills in the Niger Delta, from pipelines belonging to various oil companies. The spills around Kedere leaked from pipelines operated by Shell. Shell accepts responsibilities for 2 spills near Kedere. It said it made efforts to clean up a 2009 spill and that the cleanup was certified by a Nigerian government agency. It also said efforts are underway to clean up a 2012 spill, but Shell didn't acknowledge a spill in 2014. Whatever the cause of these spills, what this report says clearly is there's an urgent need for more investigation into what exposure to crude does to people. Without it, hundreds, maybe even thousands more children could be at risk. And many more parents dealing with the loss of a young baby will be left without answers.
That report by Stephanie Hegarty in southern Nigeria. Religious tolerance in India is a precarious and precious thing. In a nation with a large Hindu majority and significant Muslim minority, distrust between the two groups is widespread. Now a court in India has ruled in favour of a woman at the centre of a row about interreligious marriage. Jill McGivering, our South Asia editor, told me the background to the story.
This is all about this young woman who now calls herself Hadia. She's in her mid-20s. She was brought up in Kerala in a Hindu family. She went off to college and it seems that she was influenced by roommates there who were Muslims and she decided to convert. That is her version of events. She then, a year ago, married a young Muslim man. Then the father comes into it. Basically, he opposed the match. He was angry about her marrying this Muslim man. He also, in opposing the match, made some much broader allegations that the courts have tried to make sense of. He was saying that this was a broader conspiracy hatched by Muslims to try and entice Hindu women, convert them, marry them, and then possibly use them in some sort of militancy. It's hard to know exactly where the truth lies in all this, but certainly in May, the Kerala High Court seemed to sympathise with the father's argument when they annulled the marriage and gave the custody of this young woman back to her father. So basically she's been living with her parents under their roof, under their control, you might also say, for many months now.
And yet now, this court has decided in favour of the daughter.
Absolutely. She finally had her day in court. This has gone now to the Supreme Court. And she said, I want my freedom. I want to be allowed to continue to study. When she was asked about how the studying would be financed, she said, my husband would pay for it. There's going to be another hearing in January, and we don't know yet what's going to happen with the marriage. What we do know is she is being allowed to leave her father's custody and to go and carry on with her studies.
You mentioned how this fits into the wider picture, as seen by many Hindu nationalists anyway. To what extent are the authorities taking this seriously?
It's really hard to know how far this is evidence-based and how far this is fantastical at this stage. Certainly we do know that the Supreme Court in the summer appointed the main investigative agency in India to investigate some of these cases in Kerala. We understand they have been looking at dozens of cases where there is a marriage between a Muslim man and a Hindu woman, always that way around, to try and get to the bottom of whether there might have been some coercion and some brainwashing. It sounds as though, and nothing official has been said yet, in most of the cases they haven't got concerns, but it also sounds as though there may be some cases, perhaps 8 or 9, in which there are concerns of a broader plot. But none of this has been made public yet, so it's not official.
Jill McGivering. $9,700. That's how much you'd get for just one Bitcoin today. The value of the virtual currency has hit a record high. It's gone up by 20% since Friday, and it started this year at around $1,000. So first, let's go back to basics. What exactly are Bitcoins? Our technology correspondent, Rory Keflin-Jones, explains.
Bitcoin are created by a process called mining, which is effectively getting computers to solve more and more complex puzzles. The whole idea was set forth in a paper written by somebody called Satoshi Nakamoto, who's never actually been identified. And he devised the whole technology underneath it, something called the blockchain, which is where every transaction is recorded immutably online, and this process of mining.
Can you say with any certainty what's behind this latest increase?
I think lots of people have theories about why various assets appreciate. And the simplest one is there are more buyers than sellers. But that really is the one here. People have been comparing it to the tulip craze in Holland in the 17th century. People are basically buying it because they think it'll be worth more tomorrow. And that is causing the price to keep on shooting ever higher. There have been various incidents over the last year which have momentarily threatened to burst that bubble. There have been thefts from major exchanges. There have been major figures in the finance world saying, you're mad to buy Bitcoin. But each time there's a little blip and then on and upwards it goes, because people hear stories of other people making a lot of money from it and say, why didn't I do that?
So how does it differ from other forms of electronic money, going backwards and forwards, not really existing in a physical state?
Well, of course, that's the general truth about money these days. It lives in this sort of digital world. But the difference here is that this is not controlled by any central bank. There's no central bank that can print more money, for example. There's nobody effectively governing it. And that's the attraction by those who really believed in it from the beginning. It's a kind of libertarian ideal.
And easy as well to transfer vast amounts of money without regulators knowing, because it's not regulated, is it? That's one of the concerns.
Absolute key part of it. And yes, it has become the currency of choice of the criminal underworld, frankly, because of a belief, which is not always the case, that it's untraceable. And of course, that has put the world's regulators on alert.
Have we, and can we ever get past that stage where it could just disappear completely, fall off the edge of a cliff?
I don't think we have, because if enough people lose confidence in it, then that could happen. It's worth more and it's worth more each day as long as people believe in it. And if you puncture that belief, everything could go wrong. One really interesting thing that's about to happen, an exchange in Chicago is about to start trading in Bitcoin and bringing it a bit more into the real world and allowing people to bet against it, short it. That could be the moment when everything goes wrong.
Rory Keflin-Jones. If you've ever wondered what a so-called corrective statement sounds like, here's one that'll be airing primetime on the US television networks all this week.
Smoking kills, on average, 1,200 Americans every day. More people die every year from smoking than from murder, AIDS, suicide, drugs, car crashes, and alcohol combined. Smoking causes heart disease, emphysema, acute myeloid leukemia, and cancer of the mouth, esophagus, larynx, lung, stomach, kidney, bladder, and pancreas.
Well, that TV advertisement was paid for by the big tobacco companies 11 years after a federal judge ruled that they had conspired to deceive the US public about the dangers of smoking. Tim Frank spoke to Stan Glantz, an expert on tobacco company strategy at the University of California, San Francisco.
The companies fought these statements for 11 years after the court ordered them to make them. And while the statements that they are making are true and helpful, they're substantially watered down from what the court originally ordered, which was for them to explicitly admit to the public that they lied about these issues for decades.
Why were they watered down in legal terms then? What were the arguments that the tobacco companies won?
The tobacco companies argued that it was a violation of our First Amendment, our free speech rights here, to be compelled to say publicly that they had lied, even though a court had concluded that they had lied. And the industry kept appealing each decision that the judge made, down to even fighting about the font size and what the fonts would be in the announcements. The tobacco companies are probably the most litigious companies in the world, and every time that Judge Kessler issued a ruling, they would appeal it. And the fighting over the precise wording of these corrective statements has been going on for 11 years. And I think finally, the Department of Justice and the public health interveners in the case just were to some extent worn down by the tobacco companies and felt like having something out there now was better than having nothing out there for more years of litigation.
How big an effect will this have? Because presumably most people in the United States are aware now that smoking is bad for your health.
It's true that most people are aware that smoking is bad for your health, but most people are not really aware of how bad it is. This has been true in every study I've ever seen done everywhere in the world. People grossly underestimate how dangerous smoking is. And so I think that having the public being reminded just how dangerous smoking is, and also having them reminded that the tobacco companies are not making these statements of their own volition because they're good citizens, they're doing it because a federal court forced them to do it, is helpful.
Given how long it's been for this judgment to come into force, how long is its effect, do you think, diminished by the fact that, I guess, 11 years ago when the judge made her ruling, social media was less of a thing, but these corrective statements are only appearing in newspapers and on television networks. They're not appearing prominently on social media. How big an effect do you think that will have on their impact?
I do think that's a big problem because social media is where a lot of people get their information and their news. And so the ruling is a bit dated. But television is still the largest single place the public gets information.
Stan Glantz from the University of California, San Francisco. Let's go back to our top story now, the engagement of Prince Harry to his American girlfriend, Meghan Markle. Richard Hamilton has been looking at international reaction, and particularly across Africa.
There's been a global media fascination with this story, but it's particularly resonated with people in Africa, and probably the main reason for that is Meghan Markle is herself of African-American heritage. So to find out more about this, I spoke to some of our colleagues at BBC Africa, and I asked them why this is such a big story for their audiences.
We are leading with it today in our TV programme to be broadcast to Nigeria because it's the first time someone mixed race getting married to a royal here in Britain. So they are looking forward to when they are going to get married. It's going to be a big story in Nigeria.
I'm especially pleased about Meghan. She's definitely multi-ethnic. We feel as Africans that we have an attachment to somebody in the royal family. She's talented, she's pretty, and they seem to be in love. So why not? Good luck to them.
This is a revolution in the palace. Meghan is a divorcee other than Prince Harry, and she's black. So this is quite something new, and the palace is going to be popular, but this is quite historic.
Are you interested in the royal engagement?
Not really. I'm not interested, to be honest with you. I just don't know why I should be interested. I'm interested in the Queen, Prince Charles, because he might take over, but with everyone else, I'm not that interested. So yes, I know that it's a big story today, but I really don't get the excitement.
And the other connection that the couple have with Africa is that Prince Harry has spent a lot of time in Africa. He has done charitable work, for example, with children orphaned by AIDS and HIV in Lesotho and Botswana. And the couple, in fact, spent a three-week holiday in Botswana and Zambia, where they visited the Victoria Falls and further cemented their relationship. And last year, Meghan Markle, she visited Rwanda last year as a global ambassador for World Vision. And then finally, the main diamond on their engagement ring is itself from Botswana.
Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but an updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download later. Just before we go, though, a word about another download from the BBC World Service.
It's a podcast making a splash.
Plunging deep down into water.
Everywhere we go, there is something amazing.
Glide in rapture neath shimmering sea.
The coral reefs and all of the fish, all the colours in the water.
Five oceans of tales and tradition.
It still is the centre of our culture.
With the mingling brine flowing free.
There is no boundary between them. It is one body of water.
But dark clouds loom on the horizon.
The ice is changing.
Will the tempest become destiny?
We're not having Arctic conditions here anymore.
Our solutions become dissolution.
A lot of our waste sinks and might even concentrate at the bottom of the ocean.
Are we drifting desolately?
In the physical world, the thing I love most, I'm watching it slowly die.
That's Ocean Stories, a brand new four-part mini-series from the Compass podcast. Join the extraordinary journey. Search for the Compass wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.